Hello everyone, welcome to Insights Alley. In this series about startup basics, we will try to understand and learn from insights shared by various phenomenal people around startups, product, growth, sales, strategy, and everything in between. My name is Arun Verma, and let's get started. In today's episode, we will be going back to the best advice and nuggets from all of our Insights Alley episodes in 2018. So here is the part two of that. As an very early stage entrepreneur who's trying to grow build their product and grow it, sometimes it's very hard to reach out to people who are, let's say, 5 or X or 10X to your level, right? Because they are busy and important people. So we are doing some warm touches and warm pings around all their social media. But what should be the first hard touch point and how should one approach that? So for example, hard touch point would be an email. So I'm interested in knowing what made you say yes to my email when I asked you to be my guest on podcast, given we had no prior conversation before. It was a cold email, right? So what did I do right? What did I do wrong? How should one approach this thing?
Sure. So I definitely think that you should ideally word the outreach in a relevant and authentic way.
Right.
And and what you did is you personalized it, right?
Right.
You listened to my words and right. You regurgitated them back to me.
Right.
And that immediately changed you from 99% of the people that outreach to me, because it's all generic emails that are basically powered by Engage.io
right.
or TouchApp
exactly.
or SalesLoft.
Exactly.
And it's all the same message for everybody. And if you don't reach out in a one-to-one relevant and authentic way, you get ignored. So
right.
You started by walking in my footprint, listening to my conversation, and then you personalized it by sharing something that vibrated with you.
Right.
And then you told me about you,
exactly.
And then you had an ask.
Right.
And you even made it more sort of real by using emojis. And all
okay.
these. Okay. All of these were good sort of personal starts. But then you benefited by having an identity across a variety of places, because
right.
ultimately I'm going to Google you. Actually, I nimbled you.
Right.
And I'm going to peruse your background to just verify that you are who you are and that it's something that I might want to do.
Right.
And then it was easy.
Oh, wow. Wow. Makes sense. So personalization and relevancy is key to sending and asking someone of something while emailing them. Makes sense. What are your thoughts on mentors and mentee relationship, especially in business startup world? Because I certainly want to be mentored by an entrepreneur who is, five or 10 times ahead of me in this journey. First of all, how should we do that? How to even find mentors? And to be honest, most important is how to persuade them to mentor you.
Yeah. I think that your first steps are an excellent example, a blueprint of how to do that, right?
Okay.
So you have somebody that you've set your mind on that you'd like to learn from, right?
Right.
And the thing you have to recognize is that most people who are active at doing what they're passionate about maximize every second of every day, and they don't really have the bandwidth to spend much
exactly,
time on
exactly.
outside. So I don't think you could necessarily expect that somebody would become your mentor overnight.
Right.
But they might spend time with you, right?
Hmm.
If you reached out to them, whether it's on a phone call or a coffee or whatever.
Right.
And your outreach would be an effective way to do that by having spent time in their trail and learned about their passions and reach out in a relevant, authentic way to initiate a conversation. And
right.
you did that, and we're having that conversation, and I'm sure you're learning something from our conversation.
Exactly.
So in some respects, I'm mentoring you in the moment, and at the same time, your audience that is sharing in this, listening to this conversation.
Right.
But then taking that into an ongoing thing gets more difficult, I think. And I think you have to earn your way there,
right?
So you have to somehow demonstrate that the investment that they made in you is having change or result, and that you'd like to come back and ask additional questions or get more. But if you set forth as your only goal and your first goal to that you be their mentor, then you'll probably fail because it's too big a ask too soon.
Makes sense.
It's kind of like meeting a girl at a club and asking her to marry you in that moment.
Exactly.
As opposed to asking her if she'd like to go have a coffee sometime, and then taking that coffee into a movie, and the movie into a dinner, and the dinner into a picnic in the forest, and that into a relationship. And at some point in the relationship, you ask for a deeper commitment. It's going to be much easier to get there than if you basically ask at an inappropriate time.
The North Star metric actually started with Facebook, and they did initially monthly active users, and then they changed it to daily active users as they started to get bigger. Right. And what they did was they said, how are we showing value to consumers? And so for them, they think that it's, you know, active users on their platform. And, you know, now that could be debated for sure. But I think the premise of the idea is still very much important, because as teams grow, and once you get past, you know, 10 employees and you start getting bigger and bigger, and you've already validated that product market fit, well, how are you measuring that your team as a whole is approaching customer value in the same way? And what I've found, at least from working at different companies, is that, you know, marketing starts to have their own incentives, and then sales has their own incentives. Product just wants to get stuff out the door. And you can start to see that these silos start to form, and then everybody has their own metrics that they're accountable for. And so it can be conflicting on the inside to try to get something done that is really delivering value to a customer, but then product saying, you know, it's not on our roadmap, we're not going to make it happen. But if you have, you know, a team that's really focusing on this North Star metric, so, you know, a lot of times for SaaS and B2B, it is some kind of active usage, because you want them to come back. And you can look at that and you can say, hey, they came back month and month, you know, time and time again, and they're using our product, and you're looking at retention. And that's a great way to look at things. But at the same time, it is a lagging indicator, right? You're not going to know until like 4 months down the road whether or not that person has stayed retained over the months. And then also, you know, getting revenue in the door is also important, but typically not what we would put as a North Star metric, because, you know, someone might pay, but are they really getting value, and are they going to come back and use the product time and time again? Again, it's not an explicit measure of that. So for a North Star metric, you'd really want it to show we deliver value to our customer in this way, and this is how we measure it. And so, you know, there's a lot of different examples, like the marketplace, right, where you have Airbnb, they have nights booked, it would be their North Star metric, because both sides of the marketplace are getting value at that intersection point. But for a SaaS company, it's really, hey, how many times does this person have to log in every, you know, is it every week? Is it every month? Is it every day? And then understanding what active actually means for your company. So
So for example, let's say it's a analytics tool. So it could be something on the lines of report views. I think Mixpanel or Amplitude, they guys used to have this kind of metric earlier in the day. If it's a marketing tool, obviously it could be campaign sent or campaign delivered, those kind of metric.
No, you're right. And Amplitude, they did a recent article on the North Star metric and everything there. And they talked about how queries, the number of queries that someone actually performs within Amplitude is their North Star metric. So if someone's coming in and they're, you know, trying to understand more about their product usage by querying within Amplitude, then Amplitude thinks that they are getting more value out of the product, which, you know, from my own firsthand experience, yes, that's very true. The more queries I ran, the more I was getting out of it. And
even in case of North Star also, it could be something on the, like, how many sprints the team is having, or maybe ideas logged in, something on those lines. Yeah, but you have to test them around.
Yeah, for North Star, we had a collection of different events that were happening, and so you could log in and post a comment on one of the idea cards, And that would count as an active user, whereas, you
Right.
know, maybe creating an objective would also count. Like, there's so many different ways that individuals could get value out of the product that we kind of had a mixed blend of different events. And so that's why I say it's really important for someone to know their own active use case and then be able to build the North Star metric around that. And I know that's kind of daunting too, especially if you don't even have the analytics set up first. So I would definitely recommend make sure that you have individual level tracking abilities, you know, using the segments with the amplitudes or mixed panel or whatever you're using, but make sure you can see the activity that a user is taking in your product, because that's going to be the foundation of even creating a North Star metric. And then the next most important thing is communicating why this North Star metric is so important to your entire company. And, you know, make sure if people have questions that they feel open to ask them, because if one person doesn't understand the value of it within the organization, then they might be the person that's dragging it down and not helping, you know, reach the end goal of growing that North Star metric.
So
what we would do too at Growth Hackers was obviously we had different assets that we could grow at any given point. And depending on the time of the year and what was going on, you know, we wanted to focus on different parts of the business. And so we would set objectives. And so objectives are a little bit different from a North Star metric in that they're short term. So we would say for the next 4 to 6 weeks or, you know, however long, we are going to focus on activation for North Star. And then as a team, every week we're coming around and we're saying, what did we learn in this week about the objective that we're trying to achieve? We may have launched three tests and they all failed, but what have we learned collectively? Are we even focusing on the right objective? And, you know, Brian Balfour is famous for the zoom in, zoom out approach, where you can zoom in really, really, you know, close onto one objective and try to understand how to grow that objective, but then zooming back out to look at the whole growth system and say, is this still the right place to be focusing our efforts on? And then diving back in, fixing that next problem and zooming back out. So it's a constant zoom in, zoom out approach that we used. And I think it's really important to have that holistic approach.
So let's say we are just getting started with charging for our product. So as you mentioned earlier also, you see what the value metric could be, and then you compare it with your cost and even competitors also. But still, how do you find that initial price point? Means whether it's going to be $9.99 a month or $14.99, $49.99. I mean, it's kind of difficult to assume for the very first time. And I'm not even sure we should even just assume that, because we are trying to find out the price on the value that our product is creating for our user, right? So how do we find that initial exact price point?
So in terms of the actual price point, so it really comes down to, you got to know your buyers, you got to know a bunch of different things that, you know, we talk about all the time. But in terms of the actual price point, we can take advantage of the way that human beings think about value. Mm-hmm. So we think about value on a spectrum. So what I mean by that is, and psychologists, economists, they've been studying this for decades. And so it's one of those things where there's a lot of science behind this, and I'm not necessarily the best arbiter of all that science. But what the basic concept comes down to is that we know, for example, that the computer that you might be listening to this on, or the phone you might be listening to this on, is worth more than the bottle of water that might be on the table next to us. That's something that we just inherently know, because we've either purchased water in the past, we've purchased a computer in the past, we get more value out of the computer versus the water. Now, if I put you in the middle of the desert and don't give you any water for 3 days, all of a sudden that value shifts, that spectrum, it shifts in terms of where the value is, because we're going to want that water above everything else. And so we can take advantage of this phenomenon by essentially asking enranged questions. Now, there's a few other ways you can do this. We've just found this to be one of the most successful ways. So I can ask you, at what particular price point is this way too expensive that you would never consider purchasing it? At what particular price point is it getting expensive, but you'd still consider purchasing it? At what point is it a really good deal? And at what point is it too cheap that you'd question the quality of it? Okay. Now, I'd ask those four questions in a survey that I was sending out. if I was just talking to you on the phone like we are today, then I might only ask you two of those. So, hey, we talked about this product. You like this feature, that other feature, which is great. You know, at what point is this, you know, way too expensive? You're not going to return my call. And then you'll give me an answer. You'll stumble through it a bit. You'll give me some more context. And then I'll ask, you know, at what point is this a really good deal? Like you'd sign up today. And then you give me an answer, you'd stumble through, you give me context. And now all of a sudden I have a range. And if I do that across, you know, 30 people, 100 people, 150 people, depending on the gravity of the decision you're trying to make, then I can start to pinpoint based on the segment of customer that you're in, or all the segments that you're looking at, what the willingness to pay looks like and where I should peg that. And there's some fancier analysis you can do with that type of data to get what's called an elasticity curve, which will basically help you measure if you change your price, what's going to be the relative, you know, impact on your bottom line.
Sure. I mean, MRR stands for monthly recurring revenue. It's a sort of normalized version of your subscription revenues. By normalized, I mean, you might have some annual subscriptions, in which case you divide them by 12, to get the MRR. You might have some monthly subscriptions. So that's just pretty much just the monthly price that the customer is paying. But you also might have some, you know, foreign currency subscriptions that you want to convert the currencies into your primary currency. You also have things like upgrades and downgrades, and you want to sort of figure out like what is the to normalize that and make it into a monthly recurring revenue number. Another way to think about it is like if all your customers were subscription customers and all of them were on monthly billing and none of them had failed payments or anything like that, and none of them canceled and none of them upgraded or downgraded, or and you didn't get any new customer either. Like, it's a theoretical thing, but if that was the case, no failed payments, it's the amount of money that you would make next month.
Something
like that. In reality, of course, you get some change. You know, people downgrade, they upgrade, you get new customers. Some customers cancel, unfortunately. You get some, you know, lots of different stuff happens. So this is why you need like a software like ChartMobile or BI team or something to put together an accurate reading of your monthly recurring revenue. But the good thing about it, the reason it's useful is it kind of shows like much more than cash flow, for example, you know, the performance of your subscription business very, very clearly. Right. It's like it's forward looking. It shows you like where things are going. Whereas cash flow, it could go up and down. Like, you might have a bunch of annual deals one month and you get a really good amount of cash collection one month. And then the next month, it might go right back down again. Doesn't mean you're doing any worse as a business. But and then ARR, actually, there's two meanings to ARR. The one I like to use more is the annual run rate, or the annualized run rate, which is basically the MRR times by 12. So if it's like 10K MRR, that's 120K of annualized run rate. So you just calculate the MRR and you times by 12. The other meaning is annual recurring revenue, which is perhaps not used as much by the kind of high volume transactional SaaS businesses that most, you know, have a lot of monthly subscriptions. Mm-hmm. But I think traditionally the measure is that with annual recurring revenue, you only look at the annual revenue that is also recurring. So you'd exclude monthly subscriptions from that. For that reason, when the vast majority of SaaS founders and products like ChartMogul talk about ARR, they're really talking about the annualized run rate, which is just MRR times 12, and not the annual recurring revenue, which perhaps means something different. And a lot of people won't have even heard of this second meaning of the acronym. So
makes sense. So I wanted to ask, how do you calculate it from a like very paper napkin maths point of view to how does ChartMogul does it, calculation of MRR?
Yeah, I mean, there is like, you know, thousands of lines of code, because there's so many edge cases. So like, you know, for example, like a customer might upgrade their subscription halfway through a service period to a higher plan, but they also might at the same time reduce the number of seats or licenses they're paying for, right? Or they might add a discount to their subscription at the same time as switching from a monthly to an annual plan. Or they might do a prorated downgrade to a lower plan while removing a discount, or switch from quarterly to annual billing while also getting a refund for the unused time on the quarterly. So it's like, there are literally like hundreds and hundreds of scenarios.
Right.
So it's easy to, that we have to solve for. And each billing system has a different set of potential scenarios that they can generate. So Stripe, Recurly, Chargebee, Chargeify, Zora, they all have their own different ways of doing subscription billing that are all slightly different. Right. So we have a dedicated integrations team of like 5 engineers, and their job is just to build and maintain our billing system integrations to make sure that we are accurately calculating MRR for all these different systems. So I mean, back of a napkin, you can do it like if it's just like, you know, you have a monthly subscription paying $50 a month, then it's, and you have another subscription that's paying, you know, $120 a year, then you can say, okay, well, we'll divide the 120 for the annual subscription by 12. So we have $10 and we'll add it to the $50 and we have $60. So your MRR is $60. So that's how you would calculate it with 2 very simple subscriptions. But then you have to take into account that you get like a lot of prorations and all these adjustments and discounts that you have to also solve for. So that's just, yeah, we have to listen to all the events and payment data, like the invoices, as well as the subscription events that are coming from the billing systems, and basically use that data to build the picture.
Yeah, so inbound means the leads come to you, and outbound means you're going to the leads, right? So
perfect.
If I write a blog post on the 10 ways that salespeople can close more deals, and people share that blog content, and at the end of the blog content, there's something that says, sign up here to get more information about, you know, close on their product, and somebody signs up there, that's an inbound lead, right? They came to us. We did something. You always have to do something. You don't just sit at home and people start ringing your office home, you know, and, or knocking on your door going like, oh, randomly felt like knocking this door. Hello. But you have to do something, but you're putting something out there, then people, the right people respond to it. Right. Versus outbound means I could be sending you a cold email or calling you on your phone. You didn't ask to get called. You don't know who I am or what my company does. You're just working at your office desk and the phone rings, you pick up and I go, hey, I'm Stella. Right. You don't know me, but I'm calling you because I want to pitch you XYZ, right? That's outbound.
Right.
So inbound and outbound, right? Again, the question will always be like, you know, who is your customer and how do they purchase software today? That's one big question. Hmm. And the other question is, what is our internal expertise, or is there something that we have experience in doing or something that we're particularly strong at? That's always how it would start. Hmm. Now, some more frameworks when it comes to inbound and outbound. Inbound, let's cover that real quick and then let's talk about outbound.
Sure.
Inbound, the beauty of inbound is obviously that the quality of leads is usually, if you do it right, it should usually be really good. These are hot leads, people that are seeking to find a solution for the problem, so they found you, right? And your product, right. Your company, right? So that's kind of a nice thing, right? The customer comes to me versus I have to go to the customer. Less effort, better conversations, better conversions. It's kind of a nice, that's the dream of every company, is to be 100% inbound, right? You just,
right.
You know, you just wait and all the customers come to you every day, right? That's beautiful. Yeah. The thing that's difficult about inbound is that inbound is a lot harder to predict, right? So if you do, let's say you write a lot of blog content and that's how you get a good amount of inbound leads coming to you every month. You can't necessarily just say, we're going to double the blog content and then get double the leads next month. That's not going to work, right? Yeah. Because it's not like a predictable amount of like one lead per blog post kind of a thing. That doesn't exist, right? It might be out of the 400 blog posts that you've written, maybe there's 3 that are generating all your leads. And you don't know how to create these hits blog posts, right?
Right.
You just have to create more and more blog posts to hit more of these leads. So the beautiful part of inbound is it's all coming to you and it's really hot and it's really nice conversations and nobody's screaming at you and all that. But the negative thing is it takes a really long time to build up, and it's very unpredictable. It's very hard to say next quarter we want to do double the inbound leads in this quarter. It's kind of like the type of game where you do more and more and more stuff and you hope some of this will hit.
Right.
But it might take a really long time. It's a little out of your control. Switching over to outbound, the thing that sucks about outbound is that, you know, people did not want to hear from you, right? So right. You send them cold email, you're interrupting people in their day, and people typically don't love that. Nobody's ever said, I love advertisements. Nobody ever said, I love being cold called, or nobody ever said, I love getting all these random emails from people trying to sell me something in my inbox that I didn't ask for. Right? So people don't necessarily like the experience. And so you're going to get a lot of hate, right? A lot of people are going to be responding with, fuck you, spam, blah, 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 or on the phone, will hang up on you. Like, they will respond angrily, which is tough to deal with. And the other thing is that you're going to have to deal with much higher volume because you don't know who's going to pick up, let's say, cold calling, for example. Hmm. If I call people, most people will not pick up the phone since we didn't agree on, you know, on talking today, since I don't know if I have the right phone number and all that. Hmm. I'm going to have to do a lot more volume to get to a good amount of results, right? So now the thing that sucks about outbound is you have to put on a lot of effort, a lot of activity, to get a little bit of a response, and the response that you're getting, a lot of it is really negative, right? You have to deal with that negativity. So that all sucks about outbound. But the beauty of outbound is that it's incredibly predictable, right? Because if you know, hey, we're doing 100 cold calls, we reach 10 people, out of the 10 people get, you know, 2 to agree to a demo, and every second person that gets a demo buys, I know the formula, so all I can do now is I can hire more and more people. Every person needs to do 100 calls, and like we can scale really beautifully up,
right?
Because we don't wait for the customers to come to us. We know how to get to the customer, right? And also the other beauty is that we could even cherry pick and say we want to have these 10 massive brands become our customers, because we think if we have their logo on our website, lots of other people want to buy our product. And we don't have to wait and hope that one person in this company will ever read our blog post, which could never happen. No, we can strategically go after these companies and eventually get them to purchase, right? Or a lot of them to purchase. That's a powerful position. You can be active. You don't have to wait for them to find you. You can go and find them and make it happen. That's the beauty of it. So both models have pros and cons. Typically, the inbound model works can work both for massive deals, right? An enterprise client could find you in an inbound way, right? As well as a small client could find you. But typically, if you're making very little revenue per customer, you're going to have to focus more on an inbound model because it's more economical, right? Writing a lot of blog posts and then waiting for people to come to you is not as expensive as having, tons of salespeople making thousands of calls trying to reach somebody to talk to them, right? It's a lot more expensive. So typically, if there's a division, inbound is more for smaller deals and outbound is more for larger deals, because outbound is much more expensive, much more labor intense. And it's not just any kind of labor. It has to be skilled labor, and that labor has to go through a lot of pain, emotional pain, right? Of getting screamed at and hung up on and all that stuff. So you have to pay them really, really well and compensate them really well. So usually outbound is for larger kind of deals, enterprise level deals and customer bases, and inbound is more for small ones. Now, obviously, you know, you can do both, right? And many businesses do. But if there's a division of how to think about it, you know, if you say we want to sell $1 million deals and we want to sell to Fortune 500 companies, starting to write blog posts and hoping that they will come to you is not going to be a successful strategy, right? That's not going to work that well. Similarly, not always, but in many cases, if you want to sell successfully to SMB, it may or may not be feasible to doing, you know, visiting them at their office, right? Having like a field sales force go out there and visit one-on-one on them. So it depends on how long your sales cycle is, who's buying from you, how much money they pay you. But in general, both inbound and outbound have pros and cons. Oftentimes you will start with inbound and you would take a very long approach and go, you know what, we're going to invest in this as a marketing channel and we're going to invest in this for the next 12 to 18 months and see what happens, right? And take a really long approach. And then when it comes to outbound, you're going to look at, can we identify phone numbers, contact details of our buyers? How long does it take for us to reach them? How long does it take for us to sell them? And how much does it take, you know, how much money does it take for us to hire a salesperson to do all these things? And how much money do they pay us in return? Do the economics work, right? If it costs you $100,000 to acquire a customer and the customer is paying you $100 a month, it's never going to work, right? So you just look at some basic math, back off of the envelope math, and say, can we afford to do outbound? And if so, how could the math work? And then you try it out and see if it works or not. And based on that, you can scale it.
That's it, folks. Thanks for tuning in. Show notes would be available in the link below, or you can just go to insightsally.com/notes. Please rate, review, subscribe in whichever app you are listening to this episode. And most importantly, give feedback in comments, reviews, or you can just email me at arun@insightsalley.com. You can also follow and connect with me on Instagram, Twitter, etc. My handle everywhere is arun11192. And remember, always be learning. Bye.